I'm Brian Russo, and welcome back to Coastal Connection. Coming up in just a bit, we'll head up in the air to find out all about the art of sky typing. First, though, we'll stay on solid ground for a bit and spend some time in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. Rehoboth is a place that at first glance may seem to have experienced far more pleasure than hardship. It's got beautiful high-end homes and upscale restaurants. Vacationers stroll down Rehoboth Avenue eating ice cream and wandering in and out of boutiques. There are author events at the local bookstore and bars that cater to the late-night crowd. But Rehoboth's history is also marked by destruction. Storms have pounded this resort over and over again, taking businesses and homes with them and forcing residents to rebuild. That history and the broader tale of Rehoboth's growth and transformation over the years is the focus of a new series of walking tours being hosted by the Rehoboth Beach Historical Society and Museum. Our managing producer, Tara Boyle, swung by the town to take the tour and learn a bit about Rehoboth's stormy past.
Our tour begins right in the heart of Rehoboth, in the middle of the town's bandstand, looking out over the beach and to the ocean beyond.
Here we are.
Feels good, doesn't it?
It does. Doesn't it? Oh, that sea breeze.
Our tour guide today is a retired teacher named Jean Broland.
We've nicknamed the part of the tour that we're going to take this morning the Storm Tour, and we're going to talk about some of the big storms that have hit the Delaware coast.
But before we talk storms, we should begin with the first people who vacationed in Rehoboth.
The first vacationers were the Indians. We are the Native Americans. We had the Lenapes, the Assateague, and the Nanticoke Indians that would come here for the same reasons that we do, the ocean breeze. This is higher ground than a lot of the beaches, and also we have two freshwater lakes, and we're close to the bay so they could get their seafood. So they were here, and they had to contend with either the English or the Dutch, whoever was in charge of Lewis. Now, Lewis is 300 years old. Rehoboth is 150.
In 1873, Methodists arrived in Rehoboth and founded the Rehoboth Beach Camp Meeting Association of the Methodist Episcopal Church. Jean Broland says the group built a tabernacle, a place to host religious meetings and breathe a bit of salt air during the summer months.
And they laid out the town, similar as it is today, with lots so people could come and set up tents. And they did canvas tents, and then they started making tent houses. So this became a Methodist retreat.
But the Methodists didn't get to keep Rehoboth Beach to themselves for very long.
People got the idea to build hotels. So sure enough, the Surf House was one of the early hotels in 1873. And then a man named William Bright, who was a businessman, spent some time in prison, came and built the Bright House. And at his hotel, they had a little bit of dancing and a little bit of card playing, which just irritated the Methodists no end. Another fellow that built a hotel was a famous name here in Rehoboth, a familiar name, John A. Lingo, built the Atlantic Hotel in 1875. So people, not only Methodists, but other people were starting to come to Rehoboth Beach as well.
After the hotels came the railroad.
And by 1878, the railroad had come to Harrington, Delaware, and then it moved up into Rehoboth and actually came right down Rehoboth Avenue. And at that time, you can see the Carlton Hotel, the brick hotel. Mm-hmm. That was in its heyday because the people got off the train and they had a hotel waiting for them right there.
But the more hotels and homes were built in Rehoboth, the more there was to be destroyed in a big storm.
Right here at the end of Rehoboth Avenue was Horn's Pavilion, and he built a 150-foot pier right out into the ocean. And it had a skating rink, theater, shops. It was amazing.
Wow.
It did wash away with the 1914 storm and was never rebuilt again. But that was a big deal. We had at the Candy Kitchen, it used to be a casino hotel, and then later on, that was replaced by the famous Bellhaven Hotel, and that was a landmark in Rehoboth until 1962, when that was washed away.
Washed away is a recurring theme in this town. Fires have also been a big problem here over the years, a fact that becomes clear as we walk down Rehoboth Avenue and cut across to Baltimore Avenue.
And there's no old beach architecture along here because it was all burned down. And rumor has it that the fires were caused by the German tradition of putting lighted candles on Christmas trees. So there, you know, you will see none of the old houses like the green one across the street, Jam. None of that architecture is around.
Between storms and fires, it seems the history is clearly here, but in a lot of cases you have to look. In a lot of cases, the businesses have become something totally different. How do you hold on to the history in a community that's forever changing like this one?
Well, there, I think part of having the Rehoboth Beach Historical Society and the museum to document some of these changes, Rehoboth is a resilient community, and as times change, you know, the desires and needs of the community changes, but people come here for a vacation and to relax and to have a good time and have good food, and basically that's what drives Rehoboth, is to be sure when people come here they do have a good time, and they're constantly trying to keep things clean, fresh, and safe.
That last one, safe, was a particular concern 100 years ago, back when everyone wore wool bathing suits to splash around in the water. Those suits, no surprise, got really heavy when wet. But as Jean Broland and I walk down Baltimore Avenue and onto the boardwalk, she says the early residents of Rehoboth came up with a solution.
They installed a surf line out there, so people in those 30-pound drenched heavy bathing suits, it was a line that ran from the beach into the ocean, and they could pull themselves out of the ocean onto the beach to be safe, because it was a real challenge if your suit was waterlogged and the waves were rough.
Right.
So that was one of the things that the Village Improvement Association did. They also continued the mosquito campaign. There was a lady, Mary Thompson Wilson, who was a general's daughter, and she came down here to vacation right after World War I. And the mosquitoes were so bad that when she was in her garden, she had to wrap newspaper around her arms and legs. And she thought, something has got to be done. And she had read about, we were building the Panama Canal with Teddy Roosevelt, and about what they had done in Panama to help eradicate some of the mosquitoes. So she started with a truck and started cleaning out the debris from the sand dunes and also some of the swampy areas. And so when the Depression came, she, being a general's daughter, she probably should have been a general, went right to Washington and lobbied for having the Conservation Corps based here. And she got a camp, I believe it was 1224 in Lewis, and they came and they worked and worked and worked to eradicate the breeding ground for mosquitoes. And we still do some spraying, but it's really been pretty successful. We don't have as many mosquitoes as a lot of places. So she did a great job.
These sorts of tidbits are not necessarily the stories you'll find in history books. They're not the moments that change the course of a nation, or even in some cases, that of a small town. But Jean Broland says they're essential to understanding this community and the people who love this place.
It's a great place to be, and I've enjoyed growing up here. My children came, and now my grandchildren come. So it's multi-generational. I think it's in your blood. A lot of my friends that come from, you know, upstate New York, and even my relatives from Minnesota, they're here every summer because
wow.
It's part of who they are.
I'm Tara Boyle.
The Rehoboth Beach Historical Society Museum will host its next walking tour of the town on June 26th. We've got more information about that on our website, wamucoast.org. And if you've got a favorite memory about Rehoboth's past, we'd love to hear it. You can reach us at coastal@wamu.org. We finished today's show in the air. Well, getting ready to go in the air, rather.
So this is a parachute. The pilot will help you get into it. This is called a backpack parachute.
I'm at the Ocean City Airport, getting ready to take flight with the Geico Skytypers. They were one of the many acts at the 7th annual Ocean City Air Show last weekend. I hopped aboard one of the World War II era SNJ planes and took a thrilling ride over the ocean with the cockpit open and the wind whipping through my hair at more than 120 miles an hour. I'm not going to lie, it was an awesome experience. Bob Johansson was my pilot. We spoke on the ground afterwards about the art of sky typing and how these old planes that were built like tanks back in the 40s are now equipped with state-of-the-art technology to write messages and words in the air. But as Bob explains, sky typing and sky writing, like the sort they did back in the 20s to market products in an advertising format, are two totally different things.
Sky writing is done with one single airplane making one letter at a time. And often what happens in putting out smoke in the sky is when there's any kind of wind, it dissipates rapidly. Our particular procedure, we fly five aircraft line abreast, and we have marks on the airplane, on all of the aircraft, so that you can tell exactly when you are directly abeam of the aircraft. And with Wi-Fi technology and a laptop computer, the center airplane communicates with the other four aircraft and sends a signal that opens a solenoid, lets a puff of eco-friendly oil into the exhaust system, and it vaporizes, makes a puff of smoke. Our letters, we put out a letter about every second, and we can print words. So even if there is an adverse wind condition, you can basically read at least a couple, three words. And many times you can read a whole message, and sometimes they'll even stay there for, 5-10 minutes.
Sure.
So there's a big difference in terms of the legibility and the timing and all the other factors that are involved.
Right. You mentioned that now it's, just like anything else, things are done digitally with computers, and that's how you're sort of planning your maneuvers. But historically speaking, that wasn't always how it was done. Talk about how you pulled off lettering in the sky, without the help of this sort of, technology.
Well, when I originally started doing this, the technology was not available. Wi-Fi is very recent. So if you will picture a player piano with a roll of paper with holes in it, and the roll of paper was, I'm pretty sure it was nothing but a cash register roll, and the boss would, the night before, he had a little custom machine that he could punch letters out in the paper, and then the paper was supposed to roll through the machine, and there were five styluses, and every time a hole came up, it would make an electrical contact, which would send a discrete radio signal to each aircraft, and then technically it would produce the puff of smoke at the proper time. Unfortunately, those of you who have operated the old-fashioned reel-type movie projectors and cash registers, occasionally the tape runs off the rails and ends up on the floor of the cockpit, and so things don't always work. In our modern situation, we can operate effectively if a maximum of one aircraft is malfunctioning, because the lead can see when the puff of smoke for the malfunctioning airplane is supposed to come up, and he'll just say now, and we can manually pickle a puff of smoke off.
Now, when we were flying, the lead plane was saying, "And turn the smoke on now, and turn it off." I'm assuming that when you're in the air and you're in the midst of these maneuvers, it's going much quicker than that.
Well, what it is we have two positions for the smoke switch. One is automatic, which is which does the aforementioned technical thing, mm-hmm. of the computer tells it when to smoke. And the other one, we call it a pickle button on the stick. So you operate it with your thumb and you push the button and it opens the solenoid valve and lets out a puff or a whole line of smoke. You can just hold it down and it'll smoke till you either run out of smoke or you let go of the switch.
Right.
And that's what we do during air shows, because part of our air show scene is we put out a lot of smoke to accentuate our maneuvers and locate the airplanes for the audience to see what's coming up.
Now let's talk about the aircraft itself, because These planes date back to World War II.
Well, these aircraft, there were a tremendous amount of them built. I think I've heard numbers from 17,000 to over 20,000. And they trained all of the pilots in the World War II airplanes. They trained the Corsairs, the Mustangs, the B-24s. And these particular models are the Navy version, and they're called SNJs. That was the Navy designation at the time, and it told you exactly what the mission was and what model number of the airplane and what the manufacturer was. Actually, J stood for North American. Right. The Army Air Corps version, because the Air Force did not exist when these airplanes were built. This particular group of airplanes was built in 1940, and they were built like tanks. So with the proper maintenance, which we have, they'll last for a long time. And there were so many of them built that there are plenty of parts left. And also the engines were very common engines at the time. So there's no shortage of parts or anything. Yeah. And with the proper maintenance, which we have, they're in excellent shape.
Now, when you guys are doing air shows all across the country, are there any maneuvers after doing it for as long as you have? Are there any letters in the alphabet or any words that prove to be more challenging than others?
Not at all. We can put anything up you want. We routinely put up, at the start of air shows, we routinely put up an American flag. We, you know, it's obviously not 48 stars, but there's a star field and then there's the stripes, and it's easily recognizable as an American flag. I think the only limitation on what we can put up is the limitations on the computer, whatever those are.
Sure.
But we can put up just about anything you want.
Now, prior to computers, when you were learning before all of this technology, was there something that, you know, was a bit more challenging than others, a maneuver to master?
Well, skytyping, before the computers, all you could do was put letters or numbers. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had to be printed on a roll of paper that,
right,
if we were lucky, didn't end up on the floor of the cockpit. Subsequent to the computers, of course, the sky's the limit. You can put whatever you want out in it. And the function of the pilots is simply to maintain the airplane in exactly the proper position, because if anyone gets out of position, then it looks like Chinese.
Now, you've been flying for many, many years. Some of the fellas I heard over talking saying that you have more experience up in the air than perhaps anybody else on the team. What's your favorite thing about coming to air shows like this one?
Well, I have to tell you, my favorite thing is number one, flying these unique aircraft, which even though they were trainers, they can be a real handful. One of the phrases I've used that I often catch a lot of derision about is, standard description is, these airplanes in the air, they're like a lamb. Docile, they do what you tell them. On the ground, they're like a viper. They're just waiting for you to make a mistake, and they're going to bite you. And it's a characteristic of the airplane. The landing gear is not only more closely spaced, but it's also short coupled, so the airplane sits at a higher angle while it's on the ground, and it can be a bear to control. The standard briefing for a student pilot is the instructor will get very serious and say, fly the airplane, and when the landing's done, it's not over. You fly the airplane into the blocks. Well, I've flown a lot of airplanes. This is the only one where you better do that. It is an amazing amalgamation of technology and old-fashioned skill.
We've been speaking with Bob Johansson. He flies plane number 4 with the Geico Skytypers. Bob, thanks for taking me up in the air today. I had a great time.
Thank you, sir.
You're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City and 88.5 in Washington. I'm Brian Russo.